Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by Elec K25. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend talking about all the news in the world of sports. We got lots to talk about. We're going to get to a really fun interview soon with Mookie Wilson, World Series champion for the Mets, talk about his journey. Jeff, how was your fourth?
Well, it's Mookie Wilson's on the fifth, so I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, right? So for our listeners, Mookie Wilson was one of Jeff's guys, and we got him, and that's really cool.
Hey, I do have a question, though. You know, every sport seems to have a holiday.
Yeah.
Like the NBA seems to have Christmas until the NFL decided to screw them over. The NFL has Thanksgiving. Hockey has January 1st with their Winter Classic game. Why does baseball not take advantage of the 4th of July?
Because they suck.
Have games on the 4th of July, but why wouldn't they, you know, these special games that they do, like the Little League game and things like that, why do they not do it on the 4th of July and just own that holiday?
There were no games on national broadcast last night. None. You want to talk about
a missed
opportunity. Like, have a special Independence Day game with your own fireworks and drone display afterwards and get eyes on the game. It's such a missed opportunity to not do it, to not take these times where there is an empty space in the calendar and own it.
Yeah, just create something special. No, like they have these special, like the game they had in Alabama
was awesome.
Why wouldn't they make that 4th of July?
But
why wouldn't they make it 4th of July?
Well, why? Because people will tell you that they're not, the ratings people will say they're not home to watch. They're out someplace. They're at the beach.
I hate to tell people, you know, look, I went to the beach for dinner. I was home by the fireworks. Not everybody's a fireworks person. And those that aren't, there is no place else to go. Pizza places are barely open on 4th of July. Restaurants close early. Supermarkets are closed early. Shopping is not to be had. So what exactly are people doing who aren't going to a fireworks display, which more and more aren't even on the 4th of July?
Very good point. And while I think fireworks are cool, I must say I feel much differently about them with two young kids when somebody's setting them off at 11 o'clock at night. That's a bit much for me.
Well, but you don't have a dog, and that's the challenge when you have fireworks is dogs, because a lot of dogs just can't deal with them.
Yeah, so, my 4-year-old reacts the same way.
Yeah,
he's not into the loud bangs.
I'm hoping he doesn't just relieve himself on the floor like a dog does, but
close. So, all right.
But back to my point, yes. I don't really get it.
It's a missed opportunity.
It doesn't make sense to me.
It's a huge missed chance. They could own
it. I got an even better idea.
Oh, good ideas today.
Put the All-Star game on 4th of July.
Well, that'd be cool. It'd be, like a week earlier than they normally do it, basically? Because it's like next Monday, Tuesday.
Well, think about it.
Look, that would be a good idea.
By the time they have the All-Star game, it's not the middle of the season, is it?
No, the middle of the season just happened already. But that's why they call
it. So wouldn't it make more sense to put it 4th of July where it's actually the middle of the season?
Well, look, I'll do the rest of the show myself. I'll do the Mookie interview. You work on contacting baseball and see if we can get that done.
That's not happening.
No, not going to happen.
I'll work on it afterwards, but you're not doing this yourself.
Do you want to bring on Mookie? You gonna be okay for yourself in this?
Let's do it right now.
Let's do it.
So on the 4th of July holiday, what better guy to have on than a World Series champ? More importantly, what he is now, a caterer, a chef, Mookie Wilson. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me, guys.
So before we get to baseball, we understand that you actually have something that pertains to the 4th of July in a catering business, and that this is your new passion. So tell us a little bit about the passion. And if you want to share a secret recipe, feel free.
Well, yeah, I'm not even sharing any recipes, but cooking has been something that's been sort of a hobby of mine forever. I mean, even when I was in the minor leagues, I would cook even during the season and make big leagues, I would cook and bring food to the clubhouse, you know. So it's something I've always done. My brothers and I, we just love the idea of cooking, you know. So we decided to do something in a more meaningful way. We've always done it for groups, at home, for church events, for family reunions, and any other events that people may have around the neighborhood and stuff. We've always done the cooking. But we decided a couple of years ago to do it, you know, as a business, and we've been able to do that, but we wanted to do something different. And we wanted to do something that kind of maximized what we do best, which was barbecuing is something that we do best. So we wanted to be mobile. So we created this mobile catering business, and it's been outstanding.
What was it like for you guys to take that mobile catering business on the road to Cooperstown earlier this year?
Oh, man. That was outstanding. I mean, that of all the events that we've done, I think that that one was the most meaningful, because a lot of my family had not been to Cooperstown. They've been around baseball all their lives, but they've never been to Cooperstown. And for them to have an opportunity to see some of the history of the great game that they love was nothing short of just fantastic. And to be able to serve the people during the whole game, you know, and that one was amazing about it. During the whole game, we had people coming in and out. It was one of the most exciting and most meaningful experiences we've had as a catering business.
You must have been a beloved person in the minors if you were cooking meals. I mean, we've interviewed plenty of minor league guys who, you know, they had the meal stipends or they were eating whatever ramen noodles they could. And what was it like at that time for you to be able to be cooking for the guys as you're trying to play with them too?
Well, now I'll be honest with you. We didn't have a whole lot of money. And so I wasn't like cooking big meals. It was just maybe some things that we were having for our dinner. And we would, I would take some to the clubhouse and stuff. So, and so that's pretty much what it was. It was just one of those things that we did. And the guys always welcomed it because it got them a break from bolognese and cheese and whatever else we had to do to get through the minor league. So it was good. It was fun. Great experience, and it helped with the closeness, you know, the camaraderie of the ball team and players. It was great, great game.
Now, Mookie, every time we have a baseball player on, they always have these great stories about the minor leagues. Other than cooking and not eating bologna and cheese every once in a while, what's your favorite story of your time in the minors?
Oh, man. My favorite story is around the experience that I had when my first game, I was at University of South Carolina, just played in the College World Series. And we were traveling first class all the time. And when I got off the plane going to Wausau, Wisconsin, I don't know if you ever been to Wausau, Wisconsin.
Is that the Wausau Woodchucks?
I don't know if that's, I have no idea. But when I got off the plane, I've seen towns before, so that didn't bother me. But when I got to the ballpark, I see, I made a mistake. I should have stayed in school. And that was just the beginning, but we go to places like Burlington, Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Clinton, Iowa, and the showers had wooden floors, you know. So if you weren't the first one in the shower, the water was knee deep by the time you got in the shower, so you had to be first or go back to the hotel, you know. So those are stories, man. I don't wish that on anybody, you know. I mean, conditions are a lot better now, but hey, God bless anybody that made it to the minor leagues back in those days, man. It was tough. It was tough.
And I mean, you guys, you make it to the majors after overcoming so much in the minors and your journey. Just talk about what that's like to you when you finally make it. We love to hear those first stories, you know, getting your name introduced the first time in a big league game. Like, do you have those memories of those?
I think my biggest memory was my very first game. Going to the minors, I was in AAA in Tidewater at the time. They call it Norfolk now, but it was Tidewater Ties back then. With the end of the season, the manager says, who was Frank Verde, called us in office and said, you guys are going up to the big leagues. I said, all right. Myself, Hubert Brooks, and Wally Backman. So you guys are going up to the big leagues. I said, all right, we're going up in September. So we got off the get on the plane, flew to LA. from Norfolk, Virginia, flew to LA of all places. And that was a big deal right there to me, right? They go to cross country on the plane. I've never been cross country on a plane in my life, but I went across the plane. And we get off the plane, go to the hotel, bus is waiting. We get on the bus, go to Dodger Stadium. And Joe Torre, the manager, I have to get off the bus, walk in the clubhouse. Joe Torre calls me in the office and said, just want to let you know you're starting tonight. And I'm saying, I'm doing what? I'm starting tonight. I said, okay, all right. No problem. I thought I was ready. I really did. I thought I was ready for that. But I didn't expect that. I expected to go in and just sit down and absorb, you know, the atmosphere and all that my first day in the big leagues. But I was fine until I stepped on the field. And all of a sudden, all these emotions and feelings started coming over me. And I'm looking across the field. I'm looking at Doug. And I'm looking at Dusty Baker, Ron Say, Steve Yeager, Steve Garvey, Reggie Smith. These are guys I just watched on television the weekend before. You know, and I'm saying, wow, this is amazing. And look at Dodger Stadium and the people. It's just unbelievable. And I think that's the first time ever in my career that I was actually nervous about playing. I've never been nervous before, but I was actually nervous about playing. I went 0-for, not 0-for the game, 0-for the series. I didn't even get a hit. And I was just so nervous, and I couldn't relax because I couldn't believe that I had actually gotten there. Now that I'm here, how do I control all of this? And that's my first feeling about making from the minor leagues to the big leagues.
Do you remember who it was that threw that first pitch to you?
No idea. I don't even remember who was on the field. I was too busy. I was wrapped up in so many emotions. I don't remember who was even on the field. We played three games. We played three games, so I imagine whoever the three pitchers were during that time with the Dodgers. I have no idea. I was too busy looking at the other guys across the field. I don't know who was out there pitching.
You know, you've been known throughout your career as the consummate teammate. Was there anyone during that first series or the first time that you made it up to the major leagues that had an influence on you?
You have different people that you see, and you don't know whether because they're already big leaguers or what, because you really don't know them personally. But I got to know John Stern really well. And we used to call him Bad Dude. So whatever you like or didn't like about Bad Dude, he was all about winning. He's all about being a professional. And I liked that part of him. And there's another guy who actually took me under his wings and kind of, you know, talked to me and stuff was Steve Henderson. And those two guys, I think, embraced me more than anybody else on the team.
So you come up and you're talking about being amazed at the guys across the field. I remember the guys you got to be with in the clubhouse as it went on. I mean, Jeff was more the Mets fan than me, but coming up as a young sports fan, I remember those 85 and 86 teams and the characters on there. Talk about the characters and guys you got to play with on your own team.
I think that's funny because, you know, when I got there in 80, you have a feel of what the clubhouse is like. And from 80 to 85, I'll say 84. From 80 to 84, I saw the transformation of the players, not just the physical transformation, but also the attitudes and the of the clubhouse. And I thought that was very visible, very visible. And you could feel it and you could see it. And I think that was something that people pay as little attention to. I'm a big believer that your clubhouse is where your winning starts. And also your clubhouse where your losing starts, you know. So, and I believe that winning is a byproduct of guys understanding and respecting each other's ability to play. Early in, when I first got up, in the 80s, they were good guys. Doug Flynn and all those guys, man, they were fantastic guys, but especially Dougie. Doug Flynn is one of the most these human beings you're ever going to meet. We had Mike Jurgensen, you know, and then we have Dave Kamen, who came in a little bit later, a day later. But there was a disconnect between the players. Joe Torre, he did the best with what he had to work with, but I like that Joe as a manager, respect him as a person. So, but that was the difference that we saw. And I think that once you have that connection and that camaraderie, that it filters down to not only just the players, but coaches as well. They feel a little more relaxed about coaching you. And every player wants to be coached. Don't let anybody fool you. Everybody wants to be coached. And I think that's the difference. And I saw that transformation from a physical standpoint and from an emotional standpoint. And it's difference of night and day.
When you say there was a difference, was it a positive difference? Because, look, you came up at a time when the Mets were not a contender. And were part of an integral part of becoming a contender and winning a World Series. We've had some of your teammates on in the past, and they talk the same way you do, but they also, we asked one of your former teammates, and we asked, how did that team not win more World Series? And the response that we got was, the question you should ask is how we won one. So what was it like being in that locker room, and what were the positives and negatives that you saw from it?
That locker room was nothing short of amazing. And to give a better little context about how we're talking, the original locker room I came into, they had, like I said, they were great guys, loved them, but there was no bond. It was no bond. I mean, other than let's go to the ball field and do what we got to do. But that changed along the way, starting in 84. Guys started spending more time together. We started actually sitting down talking about the game, we didn't do that early. And so that part of it translated into us being as close a ball team as we could be. Now, to get to the original question is, how do we not win more games, more championships? You have to be more than just good to win a championship. There is timing, injuries, and all that kind of stuff. Well, injuries was not the issue with that ball club. I think that we became a victim of our own success. I think that we got to a point where we expected to win, but we also expected the other team to respect us as being winners. I think that there was a lack of, urgency in, okay, we've done it once, we got to prove we can do it again. I don't think that was the case. I think that once you win it, you have to have a certain attitude to repeat. And I don't think that that was missing. Now, I'll be honest with you, there are some moves that were made that helped, that hurt very much. And that hurt the attitude of the team, losing Ray Knight, losing Kevin Mitchell. And as the seasons went along, within two seasons, that whole team was dismantled. And I think that we didn't have a chance to rectify that attitude. And I think, sometimes people say, well, you have to make moves sometimes sooner than later. But I think that was way too soon. And I think that's also a big variable in why the team didn't win more ball games. But we were self-destructive. It's no other way to put it. We were self-destructive. And we just didn't have a chance to correct it.
You talked about the 86 season, and everybody knows how special that season was, how integral you were to that season and the very special moments. I'm sure you've been asked about that moment a million times. I want to talk about something beyond that moment, the moment that you hit that ball down the first baseline. And it's I've heard you talk about it a few times, but not often, is the bond that you develop with the man that was at first base.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes you special and him special and the sport of baseball special. Can you tell us about how the two of you, you and Bill Buckner, ended up to be such good friends?
Well, first of all, after 86, I hadn't spoken to Bill Buckner for years. I introduced myself when he was with the Cubs, actually, I played AAA with his brother, Jimmy, you know, Jim Buckner. I played baseball with his brother. And he said, well, when you get to New York, you know, and you play the Cubs, introduce yourself to my brother, which is Bill Buckner. I didn't know who Bill Buckner was, to be honest with you. I had no idea. But I did. I said, you know, hey, your brother told me to tell you hello. And he said, yo, Jimmy, yeah, is he still crazy? Yeah, he's still crazy. You know, he's your brother. And that was the extent of our conversation. I hadn't spoken to him again, you know, other than going to first base and say, how you doing? That's about it. You know, there was no cordial relationship at all. And after playing in 86 and playing against them, he's in Boston. And we cut all the other stuff. But after the era, didn't speak for again until 89, 90. He left, went to Kansas City, and I was traded to Toronto. And I've heard of all the troubles that he went through with the Boston fans, you know. And I felt really bad for the guy. I really did. I thought, you know, that I had really been a part of all of the discomfort and everything that he went through, him and his family. I thought that I was a big part of that. So I didn't know what to say to him, even if I had spoken with him. Well, we played in Kansas City. And for those of you who were quite, you know, familiar with Kansas City back in the day, the batting cages were down the left field line, and their clubhouse was down the right field line. So the visitor clubhouse was over there on the left field line. So we're out stretching, getting ready to, you know, to go hit. And I'm running my sprints up and, you know, from the line to center field like I always did. And I happened to see Buckner on the left field line with, you know, getting ready to come over to hit. And I'm trying everything in my power to be in center field when he comes down the right field line. I don't know what to say. And for some reason, he got delayed. And I ended up on the left field line. So I'm down, I'm doing my stretching, getting ready. And all of a sudden, here comes Buckner, and he has a bat in his hand. And all kinds of crazy things go into my mind right about this time. And he stands over me with the bat on his shoulder and says, and just looks at me and says, hey, Mookie, you want to hit me some ground balls? That did it. I was floored. And we had a laugh, nice little laugh and chuckle about it. And exchanged a few words, then he went on. And then a couple of years later, we got in contact with each other and we started doing things together. He was reluctant at the time, and I was reluctant at the time because I didn't know how I was going to react, how I was going to affect him. You know, but we became just the best of friends. We had conversations about the game. We had conversations about the play. We had conversation about how it affected his life, and I told him how it affected my life. And he said his words verbatim. He said, you know, the sad thing about the whole play is, man, no one ever remembered us as players. They'll all remember the play. And I said, yeah. He said, well, we'll just embrace it. You know, let's just embrace it, you know, and do what we can just to make the best of it. And we just began doing appearances together. We did fundraisers together, did some charity together. We did interviews together on TV, radio, you did. And it developed into a relationship that I didn't have with anybody else. Not, you know, not even some of my own teammates.
When I told a friend that we were going to be interviewing you, he told me how he had a signed baseball with both you and Bill on it. And, you know, I think it's amazing how not only were you able to do things together, but you know, you guys would do baseball camps together, and the players would talk about how you were able to teach them about winning and losing from the perspective you experienced. I was curious if you could just explain that more, because I can't imagine the agony and ecstasy that you both were able to bring to those young kids when you were talking to them.
Well, first of all, I guess I do know why, and I understand. They were surprised that we were even together. It is thought that we should have been as mortal enemies, you know, and nothing could be farther from the truth. And I think it helped people when they saw us, particularly kids, when they saw us together. And he tells his story, And I tell my story, and they say, "Hey, well, you guys together." I know we went to the Cal Ripken Baseball Academy, and we had that same. We talked to the parents, we talked to the players, we talked to the coaches, and I think that it's one of the most. It's one of the great things of baseball. It's one of the great things that I think kids need to understand is that, losing is a part of the game. Losing is a part of the game. And you have to find a way to enjoy the game for what it is. And I think that's the message that we shared and we try to relay, to people. And that just because he's across the field, we're going to compete, but we still have to treat each other with humility and dignity. And I think that we were examples of that. Because to ordinary people, there's nothing we should have had in common, but we did, and if you take time to do that, then you still can be competitive, but just understand that your competition, your competitor is also a human being, and so you got to treat them that way.
You know, not only did you do the camp that Jason talked about and going around together, you had a chance to do Curb Your Enthusiasm together.
Ah.
As a Curb fan, I have to ask, what was that experience like for you?
I had a very little part on that, and I got on there all because of Bill. Bill asked me, would I mind coming on and doing a part of Curb. I never watched Curb Enthusiasm. Okay, let me make that clear. I had never watched it. And so I wasn't familiar with the show. But when he called and asked me to join him on it, of course, I accepted it, just because we had made an agreement that whenever one of us do something, we will call the other. And before we accepted any invitation, we always called each other. That's the agreement that we had between each other. And he called, and I said, okay, all right, no problem. But just to be on the set, and a lot of things that we did didn't make the show. And that's the fun part. We were walking in the park and stuff, and people throwing frisbees, and I'm missing them, and he's saying, "Yeah, see, you miss things too." That kind of stuff.
Where can we
Never,
get those outtakes?
yeah. See, they never show that kind of stuff. And then, even when we get in the car, evidently we were riding together, and he's on the passenger side, and he throws me the keys, and I drop the keys, and he says, "See, it happens," that kind of stuff.
That's awesome.
But. It was one of the greatest things. And we had a chance to really talk. And that was one of my best moments with Bill, because he kind of, for lack of a better term, he really let his hair down and he just let it all fly. And he was very candid about everything. And because on that show, you have to be, because there's no script. So everything is ad-libbed, and it was really, really great, man. I loved it. It's one of the great moments, of our relationship that we've had.
I gotta ask, what's it like? I mean, you're somebody who has been celebrated for their time with the team, inducted into the Hall of Fame, part of the 25th anniversary team. They retired your number, and people still chant your name all these years later. What's that like to be so beloved in a city?
It's humbling. Because the one thing I've always appreciated the fans in New York has always been good. They can be tough, but they've always been good and loyal, and I appreciate that. My good days, my bad days, I wanted them to appreciate the effort that I gave, and they did. And I've been rewarded for my effort, if not monetarily. But from the reception that I get wherever I go. And that's where you can't put a dollar figure on things like that. It's just amazing. And I do, I love it. When the, yeah, I have to admit, do I really love it. And sometimes it makes you feel that you're bigger than life itself, but I understand them and I appreciate them. And I want them to know that I appreciate everything that they do. I appreciate the past. And how they greet me even to this day. We have kids that, 10 years old, never saw me play, but they greet me as if so that means that someone is giving them some information about what I contribute to the ball club. It may not be the glorious numbers and all that kind of stuff, but I was a Met. And I think that's the most important thing.
But Mookie, I think it's more that you say that younger fans know who you are. I think it's not just because of what you did on the field. I think it's that you as long as I've known who you are, I've known you to be involved in the community. And I think that that work that you do in the community, all that you do, is just as important as what you do on a ball field. How is it that you became the man that you are as somebody who does so much off the field and is so involved in the communities in which you are involved?
I think number one, I wasn't afraid of people. I didn't want to leave, have a sh I wanted to be, I wanted to enjoy the fact that I was a Major League Baseball player. And you can't enjoy that if you're going to shelter yourself from the very people that support you. And that was my main purpose. I wanted people to understand that, yes, I played Major League Baseball, but I have a family. And I do the same thing that you do. I cut my own grass, I have kids, and I go through the same pressures and stuff at home that you do. And I'm not afraid to let them see that part of me. And I think that's been one of the things that I've really wanted to make sure that I let people understand is that I'm not a saint. If you want me to be a role model, I'll accept that title. All right. But I also want you to know that your future is in your hand. If I can do anything or say anything that helps you along the way, then I'm going to do that. And I can only do that is I am visible. I wanted to be visible in the community. I want to be visible in New York. And I didn't really plan all of this. It's just the way that I was brought up.
I got one more before we finish up. I gotta ask you. I mean, we talked about your barbecue skills, your baseball skills, you're a Renaissance man, you're a truck driver too. Talk to me about the professor and where that came from.
Truck driving has been one of the things that I've always done. I grew up on a farm and I've been driving trucks all my life. But when I went to school and then eventually, face to baseball, you kind of put all that that's behind you. But I never lost the love for driving big trucks. And when I retired, I had to find something to do. So when I first started driving trucks, you didn't have to have a CDL. If you could drive a truck, you drive a truck. Big deal. I'm probably telling my age now, but that's all right. We live with that today. But anyway, so I had to be certified. So I went to this truck driving institution called Truck Drivers Institute in little north of Columbia. And we were in class. I didn't tell anyone who I was or anything of that nature. So we were in class and we're getting ready to take our tests and stuff. And they said, okay, now, excuse me. They said, okay, the teacher said, okay. And he was an old truck driver from old school. He said, okay, everybody has to come up with a handle, your CB handle. You had to have a CB handle. You get in a truck driver unless you got a CB handle. You got to have a CB handle. So I said, okay. So I said, I don't know what to call myself. I have no idea. So everyone thought I was a school teacher. So I wanted one of the
Wait,
classmates to say,
why did they think you were a school teacher?
I guess it's the way that I, reacted to the classwork and doing the work in school. I have no idea. But he said, okay, listen, we're going to call you the professor. That's what we're going to call you, the professor. So that's where that came from, the professor part. And then later on, as I got certified and I got my first job,
You changed it,
and
right?
then the I went back to the school and I finally, told the teacher there who I was,
And then
and they were like,
you
they're like blown away. They couldn't believe it. So I actually changed my handle from professor to Knight Rider. So that's how all that came about.
All right, Mookie, before we let you go and just talk about your catering business one more time, I gotta ask, as a guy who's standing out in center field a lot of times, manning that outfield, you played behind some of the greats pitchers. I believe that you got to play behind Tom Seaver and Dwight Gooden. And the list could go on. Who was the most fun to play behind?
Without a doubt, Dwight Gooden.
Why?
Without a doubt. I love playing behind Tonka. Tonka just dissect guys. I mean, he was fantastic. Dwight had this presence on the mound, and as a young player, you just don't, you did, I never seen that before. I mean, I played with guys his age in high school, and just play at that level. I've never seen anything like that before in my life. I would find myself just admiring what he was doing instead of paying attention to my job in center field. I like I tell him a lot of times, when he pitched, that was my day off. Now I'm not getting a whole lot of work today. He was the most amazing guy I've ever seen. He did things that you until this day, I haven't seen anyone quite like this kid was. He was just amazing. His poise, his control. He could do whatever he wanted to do on the mound. He was fearless, and I've never seen him shaken. He always find a way to battle through. And I can't say what you say when he didn't have his good stuff. I never seen a day when he didn't have his good stuff. So put it that way. But it was always amazing. But he's been the most amazing guy I ever had to play behind.
All right. Well, you made it clear you're not going to give us your recipes.
Yo, no,
So
God can't do that.
if you're not going to give us your recipes, where exactly can we get this delicious food?
Well, if you want to, the one thing we do, we specialize in cook and serve. We cook everything on site. Everything is freshly done. We don't use any processed food. We don't do any of that kind of stuff. Everything is cooked on site from scratch. That's what we do. That's why it takes us so long. But if you want our foods, you have to invite me over to your event.
Now you be
But
careful. You're going to get an invitation from Jeff like 10 minutes after we finish this interview if you say that.
well,
How many people do we need to have?
He'll be eating your barbecue
okay.
and picking your baseball brain on that 86 Mets team.
Because we are a mobile caterer and we are based out of South Carolina, we recommend 100 people. Now I'll be honest, we will do less than 100, but you have to pay me for 100. All right, put it that way.
So you're saying Jeff and I have to find some friends.
You have to find some friends. You have to
We'll find some
find
friends. Don't
some
worry.
friends. And we are full service. So you tell us what you need and what you want. And we are, work it out from there. It's easy to do. We have a website. It's legacycatering.net. And we have an email. Is legacycatering21@gmail.com. So that is how you can contact us and tell us about yourself and what you have, and then we'll go from there. There is no set. We have a menu that you get to choose from what you want to serve you. And our basic package includes maybe like three meats and two sides, drinks and that kind of stuff.
You're making me want to take a road trip, Mookie.
So
We
that's
had a
our
party
basic
2 weeks
package.
ago here. We could have had you.
Yeah, gotta work
Oh
on
yeah.
that.
Oh yeah. I mean, we go anywhere. We go from Florida to New York. That's what we've done so far.
Well,
So
you also were catering stuff at the Brooklyn Cyclones game a couple
we
of
did
weeks
the Brooklyn
ago.
Cyclones last month. Yes, we well, in May. We did the Brooklyn Cyclones. As a matter of fact, we did Hooperstown on that, what's it, Saturday, and then we did Brooklyn on that Sunday. So we traveled, and then we did Citi Field 2 days later.
We get to catch
So,
you to Citizens Bank soon. I mean, I know you're a Met and everything, but we still eat
yeah.
good barbecue down here in Philly, so.
Well, we are looking at that right now, and we will. It don't matter about Met. We know when barbecue ain't about Met. It's about good barbecue.
That's
All
what I'm
right.
talking about.
So yeah. So I'm hoping to do that to ballparks, and it's kind of difficult because. There are certain rules in certain ballparks, and you have to be kind of attentive to those rules and stuff. We don't want to break any rules and stuff. We don't want to start cooking, and all of a sudden we have people come kicking us out of the ballpark, out of the parking lot. So,
We'll be waiting outside.
yeah, well,
Jeff will take
yeah,
the
that's good.
leftovers.
But we prefer to do it outside in parking lots and stuff like that. That's the way we do it, and it's just we set up and normally. If we set up, we'll start cooking sometime 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
You know what? We've kept you too long, and we so
No,
appreciate
no, go
you
ahead.
so appreciate your time. But I got to ask the question.
Yeah.
You seem to have a passion for everything you do, from baseball to community service to now cooking
to truck driving.
Yeah.
Where does it come from, Mookie?
My parents. My father was a he was a guy who he was a jack of all trades, put it that way. He did everything. He built, he was a farmer. He did it all. And he taught us to love the game and love what we do. He always said, if you're going to be a ditch digger, be the best ditch digger in the world. You know, and he instilled that in all of us. And my mother was a cook. She cooked for the state, for the school system for years. And that's when school things were cooked from scratch. They didn't have things brought in and you heat it up. This is when she had to get up in the morning and cook breakfast for the kids and then cook lunch for the kids. And this is what she did. And did it for years. And she taught us all how to cook. And with a family of, when we had 12 kids in our family. So it was very important that we understood how to be self-sufficient. And we learned how to cook. And the greatest joy my mother ever had was watching people eat her food. She just, she would invite people off the street. They come in. We got plenty. Come on. No, we didn't, Mom. We don't have plenty. But come on, let's eat. And that's just the way she was. You come to her house, you were eating before you left. That's just the way it was.
Well, and now you're carrying it on.
Yeah, now people experience. Yeah.
Well, that's where we get the name from, Legacy. Legacy Catering. This is where it all comes from. And, you know, we also have a another part that we call Legacy United, which is that's our brother, my brothers. It's all about our, my brothers. It's all family. And where we use that to kind of carry on what my father did, builder. So we renovate houses, homes and stuff. We do that kind of stuff too. So we run do small renovations and stuff for homes of people. So that's where we all
see. I could use you for that too.
Yeah.
Jeff's working.
We're looking
that
for
right
a
now.
Contractor.
Yeah. Well, it's all good. All my my brothers. I got two brothers who are machinists. It's what they do. Been doing it for years. And another brother is a retired Air Force guy. He retired from the Air Force about 5 years ago. And he, you know, he does everything, jack of all trades, you know. So we have people in, that could do everything. And I say machinists, they're good. They work on any, you need a machine that they can work on, they can do it. Wow. So they are, we're very equipped to do all this stuff and flooring and all that kind of stuff. That's just something that we do second nature. No problem.
Just like your dad said, be the best ditch digger. Yeah. You were the best possible interview we could have hoped for today. We really appreciate the time and thank you so much. Wish you the best of luck with the business.
Well, thank you for having me. And, you know, thank you for the encouragement. We're going to keep going. As a matter of fact, we headed to New York on the 5th to do Brooklyn. No, I'm sorry, the Bronx Market Night. We're going to go there. We do it now.
Well, so we're going to follow and we'll show up one day at one of your trucks. So thanks so much.
Please
Mookie.
Do. Please do.
What a cool interview, cool journey, and what a story with Buckner, man.
All of it. Like, we all should hope that we can live as full and as happy and as challenged, accepted kind of life as Mookie has.
Like, I just want to be that excited about anything. He's that excited about everything. Like, we asked him about truck driving, and his eyes lit up.
Yeah, see, I see that. Excited is a good word. Passionate is a better word.
Yes.
I think that he seems to have a passion for everything he does and put into whatever it is, all he's got. It was evidenced when he went his entire baseball career. It was evidenced when he was a coach. It was evidenced in everything you just talked about, treating a truck driver. He's involved in his church. He's involved in so many things, and he doesn't, nothing's left on the floor.
Nah, it's, that was fun. And I mean, look, I wasn't the Mets fan growing up. I know he was more your guy. But that was a cool interview.
And you know what? People are going to ask, well, how could you not ask about the moment the ball went through Bill Buckner's life?
Yeah, many times he's been asked that question.
Who listening to this hasn't heard that story 1,000 times? And how many times has he been asked that story? But how many times have you gotten to hear the aftermath of the story, the friendship that developed, the fact that they were on Curb Your Enthusiasm, reversing roles where Mookie's dropping things and Buckner's giving them a hard time? Which, by the way, if anyone knows anybody from Curb Your Enthusiasm that can find these outtakes, we have to see them.
I'm right with you, and I'm not like you're more the Curb guy than I am. Mm-hmm. I would like it if I took the time to watch it, and I just never did. But hearing him talk about those outtakes where he's the one dropping things,
dropping the keys, dropping the frisbee.
Yeah. That's just hilarious. I really wish that we could get those outtakes. That would be very funny.
And for the person who was the other man involved in that play.
Oh, can you imagine?
Let's also give some kudos to Bill Buckner, who went through hell.
Yes.
The death threats. I believe he actually had to move.
Yes.
Because his family, he felt threatened. And at some point in his life, he was able to come to terms with it, not do what Mookie was afraid of, which is take it out on him, blame him for it, which he did not. He did the opposite. And to become friends with that person and then be able to make fun of that moment. It takes a very special person to actually be able to do that. And by the way, if you look at Bill Buckner's career,
he was a great baseball player.
Pretty close to a Hall of Fame player.
He was a great baseball player who's remembered for a difficult play. And as Mookie said, people didn't look at them as people at that moment. They were people. And those two people who had that moment established a relationship that then influenced generations after because they were able to talk about that joy of winning, that pain of losing, but the perspective of being able to do it together.
We as fans are allowed to boo, cheer, blame if that's what we want to do. But we should also appreciate the fact of how much pressure this is. And anybody who says, well, they're making a lot of money for it. There's, as you said, there's still people.
They are.
There are people that have dealt with this pressure in much more tragic ways. I mean, anybody who wants to look up Donnie Moore and what happened after he gave up that home run for the Angels. Bill Buckner found a way through it.
Yeah.
And by the way, this is a man. Do you have any idea how many career hits Bill Buckner has?
A lot.
2,715.
And yet he's not remembered for those successes. He's remembered for that one moment. The one thing, you know, we were talking to Mookie and he was talking about the relationship in the clubhouse and how it changed from 84 to 85 with some of those guys coming in. And that got me thinking about the Phillies and their relationship as a team. And that's the fun part is you talk to somebody who had that clubhouse culture on a World Series winner and you watch it on your TV and you see that kind of culture. I'm not saying they're all kind of wild people like the Mets seem to have been, but they just enjoy being with each other. They enjoy playing with each other. They enjoy playing the game. And that is what excites me the most as this team heads down the stretch this year is how they play together as a team.
I was a little surprised by that. We've had other members of that 86 Mets teams who don't have the same positive feeling about that particular team. Mookie obviously is in a different headspace. He's a different kind of person. He sees the positive in people.
Yeah.
And this is the guy who started out, if you watch Once Upon a Time in Queens, and we've had the director and producer of that on as well, you know, they talk about Mookie Wilson got beamed in the head in the preseason.
Yeah.
And I think started the season not even on the team because of his injury, but that's how he started the season. And by the end of the season, he was the integral piece to that World Series champion.
I wouldn't even be able to get back in the box if I got beamed in the head. I can't stand there without getting beamed in the head.
Let's talk about the Phillies and their many injuries.
So they're 57-30 after losing to the Cubs yesterday. They're doing this without their top three guys, basically, in terms of Realmuto, Harper, and Schwarber. Schwarber seems closer to coming back than Harper and Realmuto. They're about 75%, Thompson said yesterday. He said that Schwarber was about 90%. But look, they're only the second. They're still the best record in baseball with all the injuries. Mm-hmm. They're still up 9 against the Braves. At the start of June, when these injuries happened, they were 6.5 games up in the East. At the end of June, they were up 8. Now they're up 9. They've won 8 of 12. They've started a series with the Braves in Atlanta with these injuries. The Braves come in having lost 5 of 8. So you got a little cushion.
You don't want to give up the cushion now, though.
No.
That's the problem. They're about to play a hungry Braves team.
And then the Dodgers.
Make up some ground directly against the Phillies now. And the Phillies are a wounded animal at this point. I think the pitchers even need a break, as evidenced by Sanchez yesterday. So it's going to be interesting. I don't think, by the way, if Schwarber is 90%, I still don't think you bring him back before the All-Star break.
I wouldn't bring any of them back before the All-Star break.
Yeah, I think you give them the extra 10 days at this point.
Yeah, let them sit.
You're going to be in first place no matter what.
Yeah.
You just want to, you don't want to be with the Braves with momentum going into the All-Star break, but I'd rather have a healthy team and a rested team going into the second half.
Yeah, you don't want injuries to linger. That's for sure.
I could care less if Bohm, Turner, Harper playing the All-Star game. I could care less if any of the Phillies pitch.
Now you're me.
In the All-Star game? Huh?
Now you're me.
Why? Because I don't want them to play?
Yes.
I'd want them to play if it was on 4th of July. How do you like that?
My attitude, and our listeners should know this by now, is I like my players to be selected and have the honor. I don't like them to expose themselves to potential injury playing with any All-Star festivities.
See, but I'm not worried about the injury. No, but who gets injured other than Ray Fosse because Pete Rose decided to barrel over him? How many people are getting injured in the All-Star
when you're
game?
Coming back up off a hamstring injury or another injury? I don't need you to play in any exhibitions.
But that's already injured. But nobody who's healthy gets injured in an All-Star game.
I need you to save your games for here. We got about 5 minutes left. I could talk baseball the whole show, but kind of went off last week with Pompey on the Sixers. Mm-hmm. And then the show ended and free agency opened. And now the Sixers have Paul George and Andre Drummond and Eric Gordon. And they traded away. They brought back Kelly Oubre. They traded away Buddy Hield for a draft pick. Your thoughts on what the Sixers have done? It went the way that Daryl Morey hoped. Is it the way that Jeff Cohen thinks they can win?
They're really old. this team is like senior citizen old. You look, the guys that they got, what is the average age? I haven't done the math, and I'm asking you to do the math, and I'm putting you on the spot, so you can just get a spitball if you want. But they added Eric Gordon, who's got to be mid-30s, right?
Mm-hmm.
They added Andre Drummond, who's in his 30s,
mm-hmm.
and they added Paul George, who's 34.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of age that they added to a team that, by the way, as of this morning, do you know how many players the Sixers have under contract if they release Paul Reed, which they're going to do, I think, in order to.
Well, one, just space. Joel Embiid, because they haven't just signed. One. Yeah, because they haven't signed.
They have one player under contract as of this morning.
OK, but let's talk about it. OK, didn't want in the long run. I have concerns about Paul George's age. But if you look at the free agent market, was that the best move they could make without giving
yes.
draft capital and other things? They're locked into an older player, but at the same time, in year four, it could be a sign and trade for a large contract. Like you can move a large expiring contract if it doesn't work out mm-hmm. at that point. So
right.
did the Sixers do the best that they could have done given what was out there?
They did the best and only thing that they could. They don't have the draft capital to go out. Who's better that was potentially available? Maybe Larry Markkanen, but the Sixers didn't have the capital to go out and get him.
Well, and that was my thing. Like I'm concerned about Paul George's age, but at least mm-hmm. getting him, you don't.
Well, in his injury history, it's not necessarily his age.
Well, that's,
if you're healthy, I mean, LeBron James is 40, and I'm not worried about his age. It because he's been healthy most of the time. The problem is that Paul George has been injured a decent amount.
Yeah, and as you get older, the likelihood, as I'm finding myself, right. you get more injuries doing nothing. Just like moving, you hurt yourself at that point.
Right.
So, you know, that is the concern, but they did not mortgage the future to get it, which they would have had to move assets for a Brandon Ingram or a Markkanen or something like that. So, you know, if you decide now that you want to bring in another player with some of the assets they have, and they do have, you know, they've got four first rounders that they can trade because you can't do in back to back years, but they've got draft capital now. They just don't have players on the roster to move as well. I mean, when you're talking about opting Paul Reed in to move him and you opt Buddy Hield in to trade him and get a second rounder, like those are the assets they have to move. But I mean, for
maybe this works out. But what I don't understand is the overreaction.
By me or anybody else? National media
overreaction that the Sixers are now the second best team in the East. Well, exactly what happened to the Knicks? The Knicks only got better. And the Knicks were better than the Sixers to begin with. So I don't see the Sixers now better than the Knicks because of this move. I'm not so sure they're better than Orlando with this move.
I think the theory is that their big three is better than other big threes, but they don't have a power forward yet to go on the basketball court. They don't have their whole team together. So you would think that there's going to be more than, you know, they're talking about maybe Caleb Martin, like role guys and glue guys. Now, you still don't think that team is good enough to beat the Knicks?
I'd like to know what the over, and I guarantee you there'll be one in Vegas, and you know I'm not a gambler. What's the over-under on the number of games that Maxey, Embiid, and George are on the court at the same time?
Well, that's going to determine how much they win or no. I mean, isn't that ultimately what it's about?
Yeah, but what's your guess on what the over-under?
I'm going to go under whatever it is.
Is it more than half? That all three start?
No, I think it would be under.
So you're telling me 41 at 82 games or less?
Look,
how could that possibly be a big three then?
Because I think there are times where they'll sit guys and rotate guys and do other things. Any final thoughts? Say something profound, Jeff. Gotta go. Boy, that was good.
Happy and safe rest of your holiday.
There you go. I got you so stumped over how many games they're going to play. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.